Welcome to Caregiver Crossing on 93 WIBC. It's Terry Stacey, Tina McIntosh, and Candace Preston. We're brought to you by Joy's House Adult Day Service. Listen, this coming up this Friday, it is called The Longest Day. It's the summer solstice, and people across the world are going to be participating in fundraising activities on The Longest Day. And then if you check out the website, which is alz.org, you can certainly sign up and register to do all kinds of really cool events that might raise money, but also raise awareness for Alzheimer's. And joining us in studio, and I think this is kind of a great time to do it, from the Regenstrief Institute, we have research scientist Noel Campbell here. Dr. Campbell has received a five-year, $3.3 million award from the National Institute on Aging, and it's to conduct an interesting first-time clinical trial. And Dr. Noel, Dr. Campbell is what I started to call you, but that would be wrong. Dr. Campbell, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor.
You know, I'm hoping that I can follow along because I know this is a lot of technical words and terms and drug names that I'm not going to be able to follow you on. So I hope you can make this easy for me.
I will do my best.
Thank you. To kind of explain what's happening here. This is the first-time clinical trial. Explain what the trial is first.
Sure. The objective of the trial is, in its genuine nature, is to understand if these certain medicines might be serving as potential risk factors for dementia as we age. And this is the first trial to accomplish this because there have been some trials understanding if we can make changes in medicines, but this is really the first trial to understand if these medicines actually are serving as potential risk factors for dementia.
And what are these medications?
So these we call these medications, we label them anticholinergic medicines. But they're considered anticholinergics because each of these medicines, although they treat a lot of different types of symptoms, they all have a similar mechanism in that they block a certain neurotransmitter in your brain. Some of them intentionally do this, and that's the way they treat a particular symptom. Some of them don't intentionally do this. And so these include types of medicines that can include some antidepressants, some drugs used to treat urinary incontinence, some drugs to treat certain types of pain. Part of the scary thing to me, though, is that some of these drugs are available as over-the-counter medicines.
Mm.
And they're often found...
Like what?
Often found in cough, cold, and sometimes sleep preparations.
Real? Oh, no.
Right.
I mean, I take sleep preparations. I'm thinking you're talking about like a liquid that helps me sleep at night buy.
Yep. Some of the sleep preparations over-the-counter do have what we would label as an anticholinergic in them.
So how much is okay? Or what is the too much line?
I don't think we know yet.
So it's a really good question. So having the opportunity to do this study is actually a culmination of several years of work getting up to defining anticholinergic as a potential risk factor.
Gotcha.
So over those years, we've evaluated populations of users and non-users of these medicines. And one of the questions that we tried to ask is, at what point does this become a risk? Is it one medicine? And we've actually studied people up to 10 years. And we found that there's actually what we call a cumulative risk. So you might say today, well, I'm really having a tough time today. I didn't sleep well last night, so tonight I'm just going to take one dose, right? And so you take one dose, but then I'm not going to take any more the rest of the week. Well, the way that we analyzed actually is that each dose, whether it be a high dose or a low dose, and whether you take it for a short period of time or a long period of time, contributes to that risk. Now, let's say over a 10-year period, you had allergies bad for one spring. Let's say spring of 2011 was a really bad year and I needed my allergy medicine. And if that's the only time you took one of these medicines, probably not going to put you at a significant risk. But what we found when we look at 10 years of data is that about 70% of people over 10 years are using one of these medicines, at least at some point.
Is there a list of these medicines somewhere? Because I know you don't want to say what they are, but I want to look them up. My allergies kicked in just because we're talking about
it. Yeah, great. Don't take a pill, and I'm not going to take any more sleeping medicine.
But I think so we're not supposed to just stop everything, right? That's part of the reason we have this study. Is that true, Dr. Campbell?
That's very true. So our message is we definitely want to raise awareness. We want people to know about this potential risk. And the purpose of this study is to define or identify if truly these medicines are causing a risk. So in that context, you're right. We should not just find these medicines and stop them altogether. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that, what makes that more important, I say that for two reasons. One is we aren't positive yet that these medicines truly are the only thing increasing the risk of dementia.
Something led you into that direction, though, to think these might have something to do with it.
Absolutely. So the mechanism that we talk about blocking these neurotransmitters in the brain, that mechanism is quite consistent with what we first understood about neurotransmitter imbalances in dementia 50 years ago. Hmm. Okay?
Okay.
And that's why we're still concerned. Now, the dementia world understands that these neurotransmitters have an important role in cognitive functions, including development of storing new memories, pulling out memories, higher level planning, processing speed, level of attention. Those are some of the common domains that are evaluated when we're making a diagnosis of dementia. And so if a neurotransmitter impairs those functions, you could look like you have dementia, right? The dementia world typically thinks of this as a reversible risk factor. If you stop the medicine, mm-hmm. then your brain should function back to its baseline. But we've learned in about 12 years of research that these medicines are potentially leading to more of a irreversible damage.
Okay, I have some thoughts too. Keep going. I
do want to answer your question though.
I don't want him to leave. It.
I don't either. And you know what? We can always have him back next week.
We're going to have to,
and finish up.
Yeah, I think
he's taking off his coat now.
Well, because it gets this is intense talking about this stuff.
I know.
So here's one thing I'm thinking about, Dr. Campbell, is could you know we talk about these familial dementias, right? Carried on from generation to generation. Could it be that it's not actually a genetic dementia, but it's because somebody has a genetic disorder and they take the similar medication? Do you know what I mean? Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So here's what I want to qualify this type of, I want to qualify the contribution of these medicines to the spectrum of dementing disorders, right? So while we think of Alzheimer's types of dementia being the most common, there are a lot of types of dementias, and including mm-hmm. mixed types of mm-hmm. dementias. So you have something that looks like a pattern that may have slow and progressive, which is an Alzheimer's type, but it may have a little bit more waxing and waning, which might be another. Or because somebody has, we live in the United States, so we have a lot of cardiovascular disease. So there's a lot of crossover there.
Yeah.
And a lot of times it's fairly difficult to tease out what type of dementia is it. So these medicines contribute to any type of dementia. And they can contribute to any type of dementia. The fact that now these medicines can play a role. However, they oftentimes are not the only cause of worsening cognitive function. Okay, so while we think that these medicines are contributing to dementia, there's a lot of things that are contributing to dementia. Your age, your familial history, certainly presence of other comorbidities. We're also learning that maybe if you've ever had a delirium, you've been in the hospital or maybe not in the hospital and you've had an acute brain dysfunction, which we would also define as delirium, your risk of dementia later in life is also higher. So we think, though, if we look at the prevalence or new cases, not prevalence, but new cases of dementia diagnoses in the United States alone, which we think are about estimated about 500,000 based on Alzheimer's Association facts and figures. We think that these drugs are potentially contributing about 50,000 new cases of dementia every year.
That's Dr. Noel Campbell from the Regenstrief Institute, a research scientist there, and we will continue more with our conversation after today's top stories on 93 WIBC.